Welcome to another edition of Touchstones. Today we are going to be talking about the men's movement. As they said, is the men's movement a helpmate to feminism and human liberation, or is it just another disguise for the old-fashioned patriarchy and is male solidarity nothing more than us than the special prerogatives of our entitlement, and are we merely pursuing it with abandoned. Today we have two people whose names don't even occur to me at this instant to show you how haphazard the show can get sometimes. So I'm going to let them introduce themselves right now. You're gonna have to both use that mic. Okay. That one is dead.
All right, let me put this in the middle.
Okay. So introduce yourself again and just say what you were and start over again.
Yeah, I'm Doug Lester from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Okay.
And I've been involved in the men's movement, the men's work, for a little over 20 years. I was one of the original starters of the men's, the Raleigh Men's Center, 1987. And have been involved in the various parts of our group there and the things that we've done through the years. And we have an annual event that's coming up April the 20th out in Eflin, North Carolina, Camp Chestnut Ridge, that we do once a year. This is our 13th annual get-together. We call it the Gathering of Men of North Carolina.
Now, when you started the men's movement in back in the 80s, what was the impetus of the men that got together to start that center? What were they trying to do? What was their vision?
Yeah, I think I remember our very first meeting. There were some women there who were part of the Women's Center of Raleigh. So they were there to kind of help us get started. And I always remember we got about halfway through the meeting and one man stood up and said, you know, we're starting a men's center and we have women here that were doing most of the talking. So we politely asked the women to leave. And so that was the beginning of
the patriarchy.
Kind of, yeah, right. So
what happened? Go on.
So yeah. We started from that point and probably had 40 men. We were there at the downtown YMCA in Raleigh. And from that, we developed probably over the first year of 12, 14 different men's support groups that men meet once a week for a couple hours. And then we were doing a meeting once a month where we were just having guest speakers and that type of thing. So I think the impetus was men felt a need to get together and share with each other in a kind of an intimate way and talk about things other than, you know, Carolina basketball or whatever. And we had quite a turnout in those early meetings.
So actually, it does say something about American culture that men have to feel that they have to go to a special place not to be talk about sports. You know, not to deal with this stuff. By the way, I was involved with the men's movement at a very early age and actually dropped out at a very early age. I'm talking back in the 70s now, late 70s, early 80s, when it was first getting started. Of course, I was living in San Francisco in California, and I met with a number of men, and I basically found them to be a bunch of sexist assholes who were pushing, using the same old kind of power trips that they did every day with one another. And I thought, well, that's not what I think the men's movement is. And if that's what these guys think it is, we have to go through some kind of consensus process to show just how fucked up we are with each other. Oops, excuse me, people. I have some residual anger towards the men's movement. Lou, you want to say something?
Yeah. I can hear your doubts surfacing here.
Yes,
very clear.
Yes, very clear.
And you're not the only one. You're not the only one. I'll introduce myself. I'm Lou Lipsitz. I live in Chapel Hill. I'm a poet and psychotherapist, and I've been involved with the Raleigh Men's Center not quite as long as Doug and not as deeply as Doug, but for quite a while. It's had an important part of my life. I learned a lot from these activities, and I've attended the gathering. I think this is our 13th gathering on the 20th and 21st, and I think I've been at maybe 11 of the 12 we've had so far, 10 of the 12. Let me read you a little something. There are a few people who were kind of the gurus of the men's movement when it started. And, of course, the best-known person is Robert Bly.
Right.
And the book Iron John, which I think had an amazing run as a bestseller. You know, it was on the Times bestseller. You remember? I mean, it was on the Times bestseller list for about a year, selling hundreds of thousands of copies, which I think was an amazing phenomenon. It may be that more women bought the book than men, and the women gave it to men, or no one knows, of course. But anyway, the very fact that book had the impact it did was showed the kind of ripeness. There was a kind of ripeness in the culture, for some people anyway, to start to rethink things about masculinity. But anyway, the other guy who is not as well known as Bly, and who I think is a genius myself, and who goes on doing his work. His foundation that he works out of is in Seattle, called the Mosaic Foundation. It's a guy named Michael Mead, and his great book is called Men in the Water of Life.
He's done a couple of others besides that, right?
Yeah, he's just coming out with a new book right now. People, I think if you go to Mosaic, what is it, visions.org? I can't, or anyway, Google Michael Mead, M-E-A-D-E. Well, let me just read you this little piece of Mead's that from his book Water of Life, that where he explains what he thinks is the beginnings of the men's movement. He says, men's work began with men coming together over their wounds and losses. In these divided times, when we talk of men's wounds, the questions immediately leap up: what do men, especially white men, have to feel wounded about? Haven't they presided over the wounding of women, children, people of color? Is their gathering together a source of further wounding of others? From the point of view, which is kind of what you're
alluding to.
Yes. Yeah, and he says, from the point of view of the psychology of initiation, the answer is no. Not if the wounds of those gathered are opened and kept present. Not if each man's woundedness and beauty are involved. The way to guarantee that someone will continue to wound others is to keep him ignorant of his own wounds. So that's, to me, real clear. I mean, there are things to be explained and discussed in there, but I do think that's what occurred, that there was a lot of woundedness in men, especially around father relationships, very widespread in our culture. It's, the movies are full of this now, and the popular culture, and I think the men's movement, part of the men's movement anyway, the impulse where it grew out of that.
Well, one of the things that happened, though, you see it more in the religious right than you do necessarily in the liberal things, is the serious recognition of the need for a father in the presence of their children, as a presence of the home, becoming more home-centered, you know, taking time to be at home. So men are more consciously fathers now, and this probably is a result of the men's movement. However, as I said, it's more heavily institutionalized by the religious right. And of course, they're bringing down with it the whole classic patriarchal division of labor, the man.
Yeah.
You know, the man decides, though he consults with his wife, he decides, you know, he's the decider. As is some other folks we know that would rather have not deciding anything. But the, as I said, it's an interesting thing, is that, and in some ways, at least in terms of one of the most successful men's movement, which again is on the religious right, which is the, what's it called?
Promise Keepers, you think?
The Promise Keepers,
yeah. Do you know what's come of that? I mean, I haven't heard about it in a long time. I mean, remember they had these very large football stadium size. We never quite achieved that here in the men's movement.
Yeah, that's...
We didn't fill up Keenan Stadium.
We also failed as a marketing ploy, because there was a huge number of books dealing with men's issues, men's archetypes,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And they never quite became commercial successes. They never quite, you know, there was one guy, there was a couple of psychotherapist Jungian types that were going to do a whole thing on men's archetypes. And they,
oh, yeah.
They had one on the king and one on the warrior and one on, they only got it.
There was all one book.
They were planning to have a separate book on each archetype.
And they never did it.
They got one or two out, but then they never finished the series because nobody was buying them.
That was Robert Moore, wasn't it? Robert Moore.
Might have been Moore, but I wouldn't. Let's not. Anyway. I mean, these guys have some good things to say.
Sure,
Care of the Soul is.
Thomas Moore.
Is definitely a useful book for people, and people have found it useful.
Yeah, reflection. My take on it is in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
There were three things happening at the same time. There was the men's movement that Doug and I are talking about, which was very inward-looking, wound, grief-oriented men coming together to feel safe, to explore.
Grieving my alcoholic, disconnected, sex-addicted father.
Something like that.
I can understand that.
Okay, yeah. Good. And there's a lot of that, actually, it turns out. And then...
I know I'm not alone.
right. And then there's... and then there was the Promise Keepers, and the football stadium's full of people.
Right.
And then there was, you remember the Million Man March, too?
Well, that was the African-American response to this. Yeah, and men are important. But you have to remember, like, in the late 70s, middle 70s, as I was an anthropology, grad student those days, and I remember some of my feminist-oriented, leftist-oriented professors telling me that men were not an essential importance to the raising of children.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's weird. Because, the way social organization is, in all your kinship relationships, men do have relevance to this.
Sure. I think
women are not isolated with the children as much as they pretend,
Doug, I don't know if you want to say something about this, but, the fatherless boys and the problems they face, and then just sort of figuring out who they are when there comes a point, and this is actually a central part of Bly's book that was so popular, the Iron John book,
uh-huh.
is that there's a point where the boy has to separate from his mother.
Right. 'Cause
this Bly had this problem in his own life, I think,
right.
and had
right.
to work that out. But anyway, leaving the mother, where are you going? And who's showing you where to go?
I mean, exactly.
Yeah. And how many single mothers with teenage boys are, at their wit's end, not knowing how to handle this explosive 16-year-old, in the house?
They can't do it.
That's what we say. That's what we think, too.
Yeah.
It's not a good idea.
It's not a good idea. It can't be done. You can't. You can't strap on some balls and say that this is the way it works.
No. In fact, you have to get out of the way. I think a lot of women have learned this, that the wise thing. I mean, it's wonderful for women to have some influence on the raising of their sons. And
obviously,
yes.
Make them reflective and thinking that thinking that they need to feel and understand emotions. Definitely
exactly.
Thing.
And we're in the men's movement, the idea of reflecting and. Being aware of our emotions. That's a central part of what we're doing, actually, too.
Yeah. Because
with other guys.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's the...
Yeah, we do it differently than women do.
We do. I think so. And I think wise women know that.
Yeah, well they figured it out by now, I hope.
Exactly. And it's not necessarily shall we say, threatening to them. It doesn't have to be.
No, it doesn't need to be. Because, they have to, they have to manage that stuff anyway because it comes up in their relationships with
sure.
their men.
Sure, yeah, exactly.
They're going to have a relationship with a man.
I mean, sometimes women send their husbands or boyfriends to therapy.
Right.
They come. Guys will come to see me in therapy,
and
I said, "Well, how'd your wife react to it?" And you're going to therapy, and he said, "Oh, she's very relieved. It's about time. Why didn't you?
You should have done it sooner."
Yeah, right. Yeah, how about 10 years ago or something? And the same way with the men's movement, I've seen the same thing that women want guys. Yes, go, please mm-hmm. have a support group, talk to other men, Guys alone, can drive themselves nuts very easily. And, you see the consequence of that all over the place. All the violence that breaks loose, guys, teenagers without any mentors, any guys they respect. And,
yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and just crazy isolated men.
Yeah, that's true. The well, that's actually you're raising things. So okay, you got this week gathering, or so it's a long weekend,
long,
right?
Long weekend,
long yeah. weekend gathering mm-hmm. for the men that's coming up from Friday, April 18th through Sunday, April 20th. And by the way, I'm just happened to be out of town those days, so I couldn't go anyway. I'm going to my tribal gathering
what
of tarot that? Experts New York. Mm-hmm. You know, the great tarot readers of the world.
Yeah, to unite. Each their own. You know, yeah,
everyone has their own approach to the archetypes. So okay, so what's going on? What's what do men do when they get together here? This is specifically for women who are not invited. They what do these guys do? Do we all strip down to our jock straps and run around and run around the fire and beat our chest?
First thing.
Yeah.
Well, we started the men's center 20 years ago. So this started 13 years ago. So this is something that kind of came about. Again, in the early part, one of the first things we did, Robert Bly came in spring of 88 and did a day for men. And then maybe 6 months later, this Michael Meade that Lou was talking about, he came for a weekend. And so initially we had a lot of like outside kind of more well-known people, and it would attract more men. We had 150 men that first men a day for men with Robert Bly.
It's that cult of celebrity.
Yeah, exactly.
It even affects the men's movement. Ah,
that's right. And so we figured, you know, as I say, 12, 13 years ago, that we could do it ourselves. So there are no big name outside speakers that come to this. So when we put it together, we just asked for people if they would like to do a workshop, for example. So we have various workshops that go on during the weekend. Some of the workshops, well, we have usually a workshop on poetry. We always have kind of a popular one, Men in the Blues. We have a couple of blues musicians and singers.
Somewhere I can play my harmonica outside of the bathroom. Right?
Exactly. You know, we have these going on all weekend. Normally we have about 70 to 80 men that come, and again, from all over North Carolina. And then in addition to the what we call the small groups, we have these large group gatherings. And often we have a storyteller, a person that tells a Grimm's fairy tale or a story.
An Iron John kind of story.
Iron John, exactly, yeah. In that tradition. So that's the kind of a lot of what's going on. And a couple of things going back to what we were talking about earlier, and the religious right and the history of the men's movement. I think that what's going on right now, we don't have as many men involved in the Raleigh Men's Center as we used to, as far as doing, you know, support groups or meetings. But there's a couple of churches in Raleigh on any one Monday night, they'll have 300 men's groups meeting.
Yeah.
And I've got a couple of friends that go to those, and they almost sometimes, I think men go, even though they're not that much into the religious right area, they just want an excuse to get together with other men.
But it's also a roadmap. I mean, that's one of the advantages of the religious right. Is they got this roadmap. They've got it planned out for us, and obviously, at least the men's movement, as I understood it, is evolving out of feminism. Is basically is the way I felt it.
Well,
it was a response to feminism.
Yeah, reaction.
I'd like to see it as a fellow traveling. As we're not reactive to feminism, is how does a man be you know, clearly a man in a feminist world, in a world where women are asserting their rights and their roles and their full humanhood in a way that, you know, doesn't have the sort of biological differentiation of roles that is so-called, unquote, traditional, whether it is true or not. You know, it's true. I mean, men aren't necessarily going to start, you know, getting pregnant, but we're, you know. But the fact of the matter is that women can do anything that men can do now, and our society is more and more encouraging of that. And it does make it so. So in the same way, men are being encouraged, as it were, to you know, be happy when they cook.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They'll become a cook.
You know? Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Yeah, you know,
or taking care of the children, or whatever.
Yeah, but, you know, opening up the role of things. I also think the absent father motif. I think that it's more historical, based on industrialization, on the father being a factory worker, and in some other ways being out of the house.
Mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
in the more agrarian society, the father was more present, the roles were more clear, and the presence of the father was more things. The values, in some ways, that the religious writers emphasizing are a kind of forced agrarian. View of the world. It's, you know, it's regressive in that sense, but it isn't fully regressive, because it's, you know, it is recognizing some laws. I'm not actually all that pro promise keepers, but the but in the long run, when you think about it, and many of the evangelical churches in this area, you know, the big super non-denominational evangelical churches, they all have very self-conscious Bible education things. And they also have groups. If you join that church, you join six different groups. So one of the groups you join is a men's group, if you're a man, or a woman's group, if you're a woman. You know, and it's a separate evening out for your where you get to deal with these issues. And of course, as I said, they're programmatic. And of course, then the question I think that you need to be more clear about in what you're doing is how you're. May not be programmatic, at least not exactly. The dogmatic sense of the word.
Yeah, I mean, we have men in groups that are all different religions and backgrounds and everything from atheists to a fundamentalist.
How about people of color? Do you get any men of color there?
Some.
A few.
And we've, in the early years, worked real hard on that, and we had a little bit, but... We find it, again, more of the African-American men in particular are more associated with their church and their men's groups.
Right.
Let me say a word on this. I think really the men's movement, as I knew it or still know it, is more of a middle-class white man's movement. We need it. It's important for us, but...
But we're disappearing, you know, at least with the forces of beer. Economically, we're going to disappear.
We are?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
We're going to be poor or we're going to be rich, but we ain't going to be middle class
anymore. No more middle class.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, in the meantime, though.
Yes.
We haven't. And Michael Mead was probably the guy who's tried the hardest to integrate, you might say, the men's movement. And he's still doing this. But the other thing he's looked at, which it's not just middle-class men, but middle-aged men. Most of the men who come to the gathering are over 35. There are a few exceptions, a couple of 20 in the 20-year-old range, but usually 90% of us are over 35 or over 40.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because probably by the time you're 35 or 40, you become sufficiently confused about what it really is, what life's really about, and what being a man is really about, and your old instruction book no longer
applies.
Now what?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of kind of openness to learning and figuring things out, but just to go back to what I was trying to get to, that
is that mean that, we, that in the 20s we're just aping what our parents did? Is that seems to be the case?
I think so. And until you you're trying to be a success, there's a sort of heroic aspect to it, you know, that sort of thing, but you're not really all that much inwardly in touch with yourself. I think that tends to come later, but what Michael Mead has done on the West Coast is to try to start doing this work with younger guys.
Yeah, that one makes sense.
That, to me, that's yeah, one of the things that
even
we've missed.
Starting in adolescence.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, maintaining some bridge if possible during heroic 20s.
I mean, the traditional, like, tribal societies have initiated boys.
Right.
You know, and where's that? Where is there any sense of initiation? People talk about, these days, talk about gangs doing the initiating for boys, you know, fatherless boys, basically. Well, that's dangerous.
Well, it's dangerous. Yeah, it's
or
true,
boys initiating themselves, groups of boys. Yeah. You know, you can initiate yourself by doing something wild, but that something wild could be driving your car on a curvy road at 100 miles an hour. I know a case like this where you wind up paralyzed because your car flew off the road and hit a tree.
Yeah.
Well, what was this kid trying to do? What was he trying to do, really?
Was dealing with this issue of danger. Defining who they are.
And that's what this old initiation process was meant to do, deal with all this, you know, intense energy that pours into us in adolescence. Well, and we don't have means of dealing with it now.
Okay, let's shift stuff over just slightly here. And
okay.
We'll talk about our day-to-day relationships with other men. And, you know, I got my stories. And one of the things that I discovered, I'd never had I was never on a traditional career track. I was always off doing something weird that got me off of traditional, which meant that at one point in my life, probably in my early 30s, I noticed that I had, about 20 women friends and no men friends.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking, these women, some of them had been lovers, but most of them were just friends in this way. And most of them, you know, so I tried to keep my lovers as friends when the passion waned. But I said to myself, what is going on here? You know, so I started looking around. I said, well, basically all guys were all tied up into their careers, you know, and I wasn't a married man, and and I wasn't on a career path that was going to, create cohorts that were recognizable. I mean, I could have to some degree, but I thought it was strange. I did eventually. I worked hard. Of course, I did it through a church. I went and joined. It was a liberal church, but I still, did and found a couple of guys who became friends, and it was just sort of a natural, we just sort of naturally, fell in and with each other, and talked about our lives and our mm-hmm. issues and things. It was a men's movement type thing.
Sure.
But not without the self-consciousness of that. You know, we were just being friends to each other, supportive to each other. And one particular friend who is the one I'm specifically thinking sort of iconically at this time, mm-hmm. For him, one of his issues that he was dealt with in his life is that his mother had died when he was quite young. He had never, you don't know how to grieve when you're 12, anyway. And, his family didn't deal with it, and it made him very difficult. He had a hard time. He was 30-some years old, very successful in his career, and very career. But he didn't know how to relate to women, So I said, let me help you let me help you in a way to start relating to women. And, he'd come up with these sort of stereotypic defenses that he had that were keeping him from relating even in the most superficial way with women. And I said, you might want to look at that. That was my extent of being friended psychotherapist.
Uh-huh.
But assuming that women have to look like those magazine pictures is kind of weird. We fall into that trap. And eventually what happened is, as far as the friendship evolved, he eventually found somebody and married and became a pretty relatively good family man.
Well, can I interrupt for a moment?
Yeah, sure.
I was just going to reflect on my own relationships with men, which I think in my 20s and 30s were mainly based on competition. I mean, I had friends.
Yeah.
And we had friendly, like I used to be a handball player and racquetball player, and we had friendly competition I had colleagues. I was a professor at the university at the time, and had had colleagues in the department. We had a lot of fun.
It is set up competitively. That's what
a lot of it's set up competitively. Even though we had a lot of fun together, we and appreciated each other. It was all under the, that was all under the surface. The sense of sort of more heartfelt connection that was there, but not at all explicit, and I myself wasn't really aware of it. So, for example, I remember one of my best friends moved away, which happens in academic life, and a guy I knew really well. And I knew I had deep feelings about this loss, but at the time I was extremely inarticulate with myself, just even understanding what I was feeling, because I was kind of used to the idea that these sad, vulnerable feelings were not something I was supposed to access. Really, I shouldn't be feeling them. You know, hey, he was leaving, goodbye, and we'd be in touch. Oh, no, no, it was much deeper than that.
Yeah.
But I didn't have the capacity to feel it at the time.
Yeah.
And one of the things about my experience with the men's movement and this gathering in particular is there's an amazing amount of deep feeling in men. Amazing.
Sure.
It's astounding and scary, actually, for us. And
well, it's because it's where we're most marginalized in our culture.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it's the most marginal thing.
Taboo stuff, in a way.
Very taboo.
Yeah, and so, you know, we tap into that in the gathering with the guys together. It's quite moving. Every year, year after year, it's very moving. I never leave there without feeling I've changed, I've been affected in a deep way. Every single year, I never expect it to happen again, and it happens every year. So it's how it happens. I mean, do you know how it happens?
You know, we might say if we're promoting this gathering, 13th annual, and this is April Fool's Day, everybody. If there are any men listening, the theoretical men out there who are hearing about this, you know, I've just been told that they're going to have these profound emotional experiences. You know, and I'll be honest with you, I don't want to go. I don't want to go have a
chickening out.
Yeah, you see, you're using this competitive thing to try to get me into it. Yeah, and I'm saying, no way, I ain't going to play. No, I'm gonna go sit on my emotions somewhere else.
I know the feeling. Believe me. Doug, you want to say something about this?
Yeah. Well, Lou expressed that very well, and I think any time I remember the very first men's gathering I went to was up in Minnesota. And, you know, we flew into Minneapolis and went on up into the 2 hours on the bus up into actually northern Wisconsin at an old Boy Scout camp. And there were 100 men there. And I was scared shitless. I mean, it was just scary to be. And, you know, I'm kind of like Lou. I played football in high school and I had around guys and all. But, you know, I think one of the main issues that, you know, we've talked about the father with men and our kind of absent father, but also this sense of isolation. Even though you may be in a great career and you may be doing well on the surface, most of the men always have this feeling that they're isolated and there's no one they can really talk to about things like you were talking about with the men you met at your church. And so I think what happens at the gathering is and I'm sure a lot of men are scared to come for the first time, but often most of the people there this time have been there numerous times. So it's this feeling that we want to come back for more of this.
Well, yeah, but I was thinking is that, you know, this is the hypothetical. You're looking for newbies. You're looking for growth. You don't want to get caught into the age grades where everybody's a gray hair that's there.
Yeah, exactly. You
know? like the current speakers. I forget I'm a gray hair, But it does.
Yeah, Lou was saying they're all over 30. They might be all over 50. So,
yeah, you know.
But I do want to give the information. If you want to give more, learn more about it, and you can actually enroll or register online, is trianglemenscenter.org. And or you can call me, Doug Lester, at 325-9594. But again, by going online, you can register, get all the details. But it's basically from Friday evening till Sunday.
And if a long weekend is not necessarily your introduction to the men's movement, there you can go down to the Raleigh's Men's Center. Which where does that meet now? Does
well, it we still actually meet in the water? We had a physical location near downtown Raleigh until about 3 years ago. So because of various reasons, we decided to not have an office anymore. So we just meet. Either men meet at homes in small groups, or we like my particular group, we're meeting at the Friends Meeting House in near Cameron Village in Raleigh. So we kind of meet in different places. But if you would have any more interest, we do talk about our support groups on the webpage, and so you can find out. But that's a good point. If you don't want to go enter into a long weekend, there are other ways to get introduced to the men's
group. It might be a little less intimidating,
Exactly.
And the emotions might be more containable and dealable with the bull if you only have to deal with a few hours of brotherhood and solidarity.
And there are some groups that meet in Carrboro and Chapel Hill, Durham, so there's some local to the listening audience.
Let me mention this. let me mention this. Yeah. There's a Durham Orange men's meeting, mm-hmm. which meets tonight, the first Tuesday of every month. So mm-hmm. this is the first Tuesday, and we meet at someone's house off of Irwin Road between Durham and Chapel Hill. Mm-hmm. It's from 7:30 to 9 o'clock, an hour and a half. It's an open meeting; anyone can come.
You're right.
And so, now, what would be the easiest way to find out about that?
They could call me again.
Okay.
It's not on the webpage.
Okay, it's not. So, call Doug at, say the number again.
325-9594. That's a Raleigh number.
Yeah, and this is a group meets monthly, and there might be an average of 8, 10, 12 guys there. And sometimes we just share. Sometimes we have a topic. For example, last month we talked about issues of pride, both negative mm-hmm. and positive.
Right,
And, it's fascinating how much comes out about people's deeper levels of people's lives when you talk about these kinds of things. So it's a good group, really good group.
Yeah.
And that would be an easier introduction, I'd say.
And actually, we're thinking about how we have the so-called religious rights promise keepers version of things, but the mainline churches have men's groups too. At least a lot of them have.
Unitarians
have it. The United Church of Christ, Methodists. Many churches offer men's groups and opportunities to deal with this kind of self awareness. Ostensibly, this program Touchstones is about religious and spiritual experience. And when as one guru told me once, for a lot of people, and specifically for men, emotions are spiritual.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good way to put it. I think that is how we experience it.
Yeah, I mean,
that's been my experience. Yeah,
I mean, they by that they transport you. You go in, wearing one, having certain possibilities, and after the emotions, you have new possibilities. It's sort of like the masks mutate into new masks. Don't ever necessarily give up your masks, folks.
Well, you just have
more to wear.
Well, that was one of the most fun workshops we ever had.
The original face.
It was we did mask making.
It was a
tremendous amount of fun.
Yeah.
And then, we did various things with the masks and so on afterwards.
Yeah, as the two great endless metaphors for self-awareness is the mirror and the mask.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And forever we're men are, in a lot of ways, are very oriented towards the mask. Mm-hmm. In this in terms of managing the impression, the classic standoff in men's stuff that I've run into is where you do terrible things to each other and you can't show that you're getting angry. You can't show your anger. You know, if you lose your anger, you lose your mask, and you lose your mask, you've lost. You lost the game.
There's a wonderful – here, I'll give you this little quote from Bly's book, from Iron Johnny. He's talking about the 50s male, and he describes it. He says, he got to work early, labored responsibly, supported his wife and children, admired discipline, and so on. He goes on. He says, many of his qualities are strong and positive, but underneath the charm and bluff, there was and there remains much isolation, deprivation, and passivity. Unless he has an enemy – he isn't sure he is alive.
I
just like that last line.
And you know, the whole competitiveness is.
Yeah.
So in some ways, what we're doing is as some economists have figured out a little bit before us, maybe, which is, you can't have competition unless you cooperate to compete.
Absolutely. Watch a hockey game. I mean, you've got to have the rules, the refs, the rink.
Yeah, otherwise it's a brawl.
Yeah, exactly. What's the joke? You know, I went to a wrestling match and a hockey game broke out.
One of the areas that we have been marginalized in as men in our culture is this cooperativeness, how to be cooperative, you know.
Yeah. And I think part of the theory in the men's movement is that sense of connection with other guys will come through this emotional openness, that there's a kind of natural opening into it. And I have found that to be the case. I mean, it's not the whole story, but it's a start.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing I want to mention, and if we have time, and I think Doug wants to as well.
We got 15 minutes.
Oh, do we? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the more, I would say, nourishing and spiritual aspects of the men's movement has been how much poetry we use, story and poetry. And that's a very unusual aspect of it. Some of that's connected to Bly because he was so instrumental in the beginning of it and influential and is a poet. And his book, Iron John, is full of poetry of various kinds. But anyway, I wanted to read a couple of poems.
Sure.
And I think Doug has one as well. That we very typically use, actually.
And the anthology you're using.
Oh, yeah, the anthology is the one that Bly, James Hillman, and Mead put out early 90s called The Rag and Bone Shop of the Heart. And that's still very much available and is a nice paperback edition of it.
Yeah.
It's a great resource. So anyway, this poem is called The Wind... One Brilliant Day, and it's by a Spanish poet named Antonio Machado. And we often read this and reflect on it a bit. So it goes this way. The wind, one brilliant day, called to my soul with an odor of jasmine. In return for the odor of my jasmine, I'd like all the odor of your roses. I have no roses. All the flowers in my garden are dead. Well then, I'll take the withered petals and the yellow leaves and the waters of the fountain. And the wind left, and I wept, and I said to myself, what have you done with the garden that was entrusted to you? What have you done with the garden that was entrusted to you? Now, you wouldn't think that's the poem. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't think necessarily that's a poem that many guys would relate to right off the bat, but they do.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. People can feel that. Mm-hmm. The withered petals and the sense of loss about what we haven't cultivated in ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
That gives you a little bit of the flavor. you want to read one?
Do you have the real quick?
I'll find it.
Mm-hmm. Well, while they're looking up that poem, it reminds me of the epitaph I wrote for my father. I wrote my father's epitaph months before he died, but within the year that he died. He died, by the way, on April 1st.
Oh.
Which was today. So he had died...
how long ago?
Probably close to 28 years ago. Wow. He died. Wow. But the... I think we died in 78. And I was dealing with some various issues at that time, and I dealt with intimacy, and I had a poem occur to me. I was doing printmaking at the time, and it was Speak to me, my son. Call me father, and I will whisper your true name on the wind.
Yeah, say that again, would you?
Yeah, I said that was, as I said, it was my epitaph for my father, who I had very non-existent relationships with.
Yeah, yeah.
The speak to me, my son. Call me father, and I will whisper your true name on the wind.
Very touching.
Yeah,
I have to say, before there was a men's movement. And I had any reflections about these matters. My father died very suddenly. I mean, very suddenly, just one day, boom. And in 1966, I was a kid. Really, I was in my 20s, and it was a shock. In a way, I never recovered from. And
yeah.
Freud long ago, from his perspective, said, you know, death of a man's father is the most important event in his life. Mm-hmm. But he was thinking of it in terms of the Oedipal conflict that he mm-hmm. saw sort of as the center of human experience.
Right.
But there's more to it than that. I mean, that's part of it. But there's the sense of loss that's involved, too, about the father-son relationship and the sense that it can never be mended.
Or substituted, I had my intellectual awakening, which is, you know, normally when you're in middle school, sometime 12, 13 years old, 14, I had a friend, and we were sort of alter egos to one another, which is a certain type of friendship. And both of us recognized that we had, our fathers were not existent in our lives. So we thought, well, all we need to do is find a father image.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
And we ran around, we're looking for various father images, which made us a nuisance to some of the older men in the neighborhood. But, I met one guy who was, you know, basically sort of a mafioso union organizer. He was pretty good for a while, but he couldn't deal with it. And, you know, eventually I recognized this issue so much that I actually went and talked to the dean one day and decided and got the school system to support me in seeing my own psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I instigated about the time I was 15, and by the time I was 16, I was seeing a therapist whom I saw on and off for 10 years. Now, I said uh-huh. to him, I said, well, in some ways, you're my physical father. I says, you're my psychological father. And he
sure.
says, no, he says, I don't want to be your psychological father. He says, you can be my, I says, let me be your psychological uncle.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a good, he was making a good point.
I know he was.
That we've discovered, too, yeah. that in a way, there's too much burden right on the shoulders of the father that no father can actually carry.
You need uncles. You need cousins. You need the community, the solidarity.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You need the group of men. Yes,
a group of men.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Like and mothers, by the way, we need groups of mothers.
And the mothers need the groups.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a poem by Rilke, Renee Maria Rilke, and we're talking about dads. This is one that's always been a favorite of mine because it reminds me of my dad. And, you know, he was always there, you know, came home every night. And he wasn't an alcoholic. He you know, he was always there, but he was never emotionally there. And so this one's called Sometimes a Man Stands Up During Supper. Sometimes a man stands up during supper and walks outdoors and keeps on walking because of a church that stands somewhere in the east. And his children say blessings on him as if he were dead. And another man who remains inside his own house dies there, inside the dishes and in the glasses, so that his children have to go far out into the world toward that same church which he forgot.
Okay, take a breath for a second, and then read that again.
Yeah, read that
again. It's a little complex for an initial hearing.
It is, okay. Sometimes a man stands up during supper and walks outdoors and keeps on walking because of a church that stands somewhere in the East. And his children say blessings on him as if he were dead. And another man who remains inside his own house dies there, inside the dishes and in the glasses, so that his children have to go far out into the world toward that same church, which he forgot.
Very interesting. Mm. Very interesting. So do you have any reflections on that in terms of in terms of the paradoxes of life that it's pointing to?
Well, to me, it's, you know, I have had a, you know, that absent father who, you know, I say he was absent. He was actually physically abusive to all the children, but all of my brothers and sisters. But he, I felt like he never really did what he wanted to do. He didn't go out to that church. So it's like all of my brothers and sisters have had to do what he didn't do. And I have five children. And tried to be quite a different father. And
tried to be present to them.
Tried to be present, and so that they would be free to do their own thing, what they really wanted to do. That's what this has always meant to me.
I wrote this poem. It's called "Anniversary of My Father's Death," which kind of brings together the missing father and the competition. If I could try this one,
yeah, just sure.
Take a minute.
Sure.
Okay, this is the anniversary of my father's death. My father was I would call him a sports addict.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he spent a day of his life without thinking about, reading about, and, you know, trying to figure out sports. He had this intense, he probably should have been a coach. He had this intense identification with athletics and athletes. So anyway, anniversary of my father's death. For you, Dad, and also, I guess, for me, I turn on the ball game. Doesn't matter which game exactly, does it? So familiar, the way you spent the long hours of your freedom soaking up the drama, huge warrior men in combat, the thud of bodies, then lifting themselves out of the mud with helmets off on the sidelines, their faces growing younger year by year. We rooted as if it all mattered, as if this were the real work of men, as if we were going to live forever and this was the best we could do. Watch. At the end, after the field goal from the 37 in the final seconds, I can't raise my hollow male body from the chair.
So again, you know, what were your reflections on that in terms of?
That hollowness, mm-hmm. I try to point to toward the end,
yeah.
is a kind of the missing emotional life of my father, and that I experienced myself as a boy with him.
Mm-hmm.
His life, like the poem that Doug read, his life was he never allowed his life to grow. His life was contained and really kind of an addicted life, I would say.
Yeah.
In which he was not able. And I think this, we trace this back to my grandfather, to his father, and the problems in their relationship.
Sure.
So he was just stuck, really stuck where he was. And the repetitiveness and to me, the boredom and gloom of that situation is very striking. And that's affected me, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I had to, since I had no relationship with my father, and the last years of his life, he was unable to communicate. He had suffered from extreme forms of Parkinson's disease and was unable to speak at all for the last 4 years of his life. Not that I was talking to him in those days. And you know, so what I did over the years as I've grown and reflected on him, as I say, I have a man of absence. I remember as a boy that I would ask him to tell me stories about his childhood.
Uh-huh.
And I would ask him, you know, and I was very explicit about this. I wanted to hear about, you know, what you were like when you were a boy, who your friends were and what you cared about and so forth. He would not tell me stories. He never told those stories. He refused to say those stories. And he was definitely a very, very strong man of absence. I mean, very, very, never said anything about himself. Was judgmental and was drunk and was not present. His emotional life was otherwheres. when I was very young, and he was going through a breakup with one of his mistresses, since his emotional life wasn't in the home, it was outside of the home. He, you know, one of the things that came through for him was this, you know, I could sense as a kid, I sensed that he was upset about this and depressed about this breakup of this relationship. I didn't know what it was. I wasn't aware of this, but I could sense he was, when I was trying, I remember trying to comfort him, you know, and I remember the look he just actually, it was sort of like, it was like a sneer.
Oh.
That he looked at me with this, like...
A sneer.
Yeah, a sneer. Like, you know, you don't know what you're talking about.
And that's his mask. You know, you're talking about masks before.
But he'll be sitting there completely depressed and freaked out. And I'm talking to him, and this was my... You know, so these are the... This is the question I had. But what I did is I did invent his life for myself.
Uh-huh. Because he wouldn't tell you.
Yeah, I had to invent it. And I've spent years inventing it.
Isn't that fascinating?
His sex addiction came with an issue about his own father and his mother. Right. And basically, he never was happy with his mother. So that meant he had to marry a woman who he had never valued. Because he had that. And that's why he had this split life. Yeah. You know, which, the split life of the woman at home, which you're not paying attention to, neglect. And you're sexually involved with, you know, endless rounds of floozies, which was his emotional life through his 60s. Well, I hate to stop it right there, but if you want to hear about my life, I'm actually devoting a whole bunch of shows to my life. And the show that I'm dealing with my childhood, though not necessarily my father, is going to be coming up on April 15th. And next week, I'm going to be on Claudio's show, which is the hour before here. And he's going to be on my show. And on his show, we're going to talk about politics and the arts. And on my show, I'm going to get these old guys to stop talking about 9/11 and start talking about their foundational religious beliefs of what really matters for them in a deep sense of the word. I really want to thank our guests here. Lou, thank you for being here. And Doug, thanks for being here. And
no, you're welcome.
Remember, the Stewardship of Power, which is the many faces of strength. It's the 13th annual gathering of men in North Carolina. You can contact Chris Wilson at 704-254-4166. For information about this, again, that's 704-254-4166. You've been listening to Touchstones. I am your host, Paul Nagy, and thank you for being with us.